And I had always been interested in Mormonism. I had researched Mormonism. I used to debate Mormons online late into the night on my computer in different chat rooms, and my wife would have to pull me off and I come to bed and say, no, I've got to answer this guy's question one more time. And when I started studying Islam at Biola, I saw parallels between Mormonism and Islam that just astounded me. It was flabbergasting. And I started asking God, I said, God, what are you doing to me? I thought you were preparing me to be a missionary to Mormons. And all of a sudden, I developed an interest in Islam. And I realized that Islam is much more of a deceptive religion than even Mormonism is. It's the same thing all over again. It's Mormonism is Islam repackaged. If you don't know that, I'll throw out a couple parallels if you're interested. But there's a famous, well-known former Muslim from Turkey. His name is Ergun Kaner. He's now a Christian professor. He studied Islam and Mormonism both very thoroughly, and he calls Islam medieval Mormonism because there's so many parallels between the two. And so my wife and I started praying about what my future role in ministry was, and one thing led to another. Here we are. It's 8 years later. I quit my full-time job in Southern California. I was in middle management for a Fortune 500 company there. God told me to walk away from my job. I did. A lot of people think I was foolish because I was pulling down $130,000 a year. I let that go. But God's been faithful. He's been faithful to provide for us. I mean, I'm not living the lifestyle I had did before, but, you know, I'm not going hungry either. So I got a roof over my head, I got food in my stomach, and I'm serving the Lord, and life is good. We've been doing this full time. We traveled the U.S. now. I met Pastor Chuck, I think, a couple of years ago at one of the conferences in California. I think it was probably 3 years ago at the senior pastors conference there. And my wife and I try to get to the regional conferences now, where Calvary Chapel pastors have the regional conferences, Deep South, Northwest, Northeast, Midwest, Northwest. I haven't been to the one in Southern California yet, even though I just came from there. We used to live in California. We're now based out of Texas. And we moved to Texas for logistical reasons for the ministry, because we're equal distant between both coasts and the upper Midwest. So we're right in the heart of the country for where we need to be for the ministry. Because we travel around the country. I pull my fifth wheel. I take my hotel room with me, because it's cheaper that way. I can camp out in a Walmart parking lot or a state park for $20 a night. Walmart's free. You know, I don't have to pay $100 a night for a hotel room while I'm traveling around and visiting different churches. So it's a very economical way for us to travel. But we do this full time. And we pick a certain region of the U.S., we do the East Coast, and we do the Midwest, and we do the West Coast, and we go back again. And we're finishing up our Midwest tour right now, so. Been on the road since September 21st, left Texas September 21st, go to Memphis later this week, and then I head home. So, with that said, that's kind of who I am and what I do. Let's talk about Islam.
No.
Yes, we're going to anyway.
Well, that time. No.
And I have a secret to share with you guys. I have the answer to the war on terror. It's kind of a rash statement to make, isn't it? And when I make the statement to some churches, they go, "Huh?
What are you talking about?"
But here's why I say that. When I quit my job in California, I told my coworkers what I was going to be doing, where God had called me into ministry at. And they said, "Man," first thing they said is, "Man, you're crazy. You're going to be working with who and for what reason?" And here's what I said. George Bush and Tony Blair, who were the leaders of England and the rest of the time, I said, "George Bush and Tony Blair, we think they're going to witness more on terror with guns and bombs and boots on the ground." But I said the reality of it then, and the reality of what we're seeing today, is that these things that we see going on around the world are nothing more than physical manifestations of a spiritual issue. And the only real solution is a spiritual solution. We're not gonna win the war on terror with military might. That's not where the battle lies. How many of you guys know who Mark Stein is? Ever heard of Mark Stein?
Yeah.
He's an author, he's a columnist, he's been on Fox News and CNN, lives up in Canada. He's written several books, several of them on Islam even. Mark Stein made this observation a couple of years ago. And this was actually written in a newsletter that I get that goes out to 200 or so Muslim ministries around the country, of which we're a part of. Martstein made this observation. He said, the most effective strategy against a resurgence of Islam may be the oldest of all, and evangelizing Christianity. Ponder that for a minute. The most effective strategy against the resurgence of Islam is in evangelizing Christianity. Here's what Martstein is talking about. In 1909, over 100 years ago, one of the early pioneers of missions to Muslims in North America, a gentleman by the name of Samuel Zwemer, Z-W-E-M-E-R, Samuel Zwemer made this observation. He said, one might think the church thought the Great Commission did not apply to the Muslim world. And he's right. By and large, the church has failed to take the gospel into Muslim lands. We've taken the gospel everywhere else. You know, we've sent missionaries into the outbacks of Australia. We've sent missionaries to the jungles of the Amazon. We've sent missionaries deep into China and Russia. You know, by and large, the church globally has not sent missionaries in great numbers to Muslim nations. They're kind of the forgotten people. And that observation was made, as I said, over 100 years ago. And reality shows that not much has really changed in 100 years. We still send very few missionaries to Muslim nations today. There are very few missionaries that even want to go there. And some of it for legitimate reasons, you know, they fear. There's a certain amount of fear involved, and I can't discount that. But when Jesus told us to go and make disciples, did he exclude the Muslim nations? No. Think about this. We serve God of second chances, right? How many of you guys have been given a second chance? I haven't. Maybe, just maybe, since we failed to take the gospel to them, that's why God's sending them here. Think about that for a minute. Maybe that's why all those guys are immigrating over here. You know, you might think it's political, and some of it probably is, but maybe the Lord wants them to hear the gospel because they're forbidden from hearing it in their lands, and we failed to send people over there to give it to them. We've got a huge opportunity right here, right now, better than at no other time in history, to reach these people with the gospel because we've neglected them. Maybe that's why they're here. Romans chapter 10. I want you guys to open up your Bible. I want to show you. Several years ago, my former church in California, I came from one of the big mega churches in California, Cappuccino Hills. When we first started going there in 1996, there was about 400 people. Now it's grown to over 10,000 on a Sunday morning. About 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that, we were going through, my main Bible study group was going through a study of the book of Romans. And I had this experience when I came to chapter 10 that a lot of people have had, where you've read passages of the Bible before, and you know that passage by heart, and all of a sudden you reread it, and you see something you never saw before. Something jumps off the page at you, like, wow. And I had that experience when I came to chapter 10, based on my studies of Islam that I was studying at the time. Now, to set the stage, we know that Paul in Romans is addressing Israelites, and he's addressing, he actually goes to the first 8 chapters of the book of Romans, showing how the law cannot save us. We're not saved by keeping the law. In fact, the law was sent to be a schoolmaster to show us we cannot possibly be good enough on our own to merit God's favor. That's the whole basis of that chapters 1 through 8 in a nutshell. And then in chapter 12, Paul kind of puts that into what I call practical Christian living from chapter 12 to 16, the end of the book. But in between 8 and 12, he has this interlude, chapter 9, 10, and 11, where he's grieving over his fellow Israelites because he knows they're still in bondage to keeping of the law. And he wants to share the gospel with them. He wants to show them how they can be set free from the keeping of the law, from being in bondage to keeping of the law. In fact, I think in chapter 9, verse 2, he says, I wish I myself could be accursed. Or chapter verse 3. For I could wish that I myself were accursed, suffer from Christ for the sake of my brethren. He says, I wish I could be accursed on their behalf so that they could know the gospel, so they could be set free. And you can almost sense in chapters 9, 10, 11, Paul's, you can sense the anxiety and the angst and the grief that he's experiencing. I wish these guys would just get it. Is really what he's saying. They don't get it. I cry over them. I weep over them. And in chapter 10, he writes the following words. He says, brethren, my heart's desire and my prayer to God for them is for their salvation. For I testify about them that they have a zeal for God, but not in accordance with knowledge. For not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. And when I read that, something jumped out the page at me that I'd never seen before, and I made a margin of it. I've got it right here. This is the very Bible I was using. My note's still here in my margin. I want to suggest to you that maybe these first 4 verses of chapter 10 also applies to another people group today. And I'm going to reread it, and I'm going to substitute one word. And I want you to tell me if it fits. Now, we know by context that Paul's talking about Israelites. In fact, I think the word Israelites is in the New King James. If you have a New King James, you'll see the word Israelites there. It's not in the original Greek. We know by context that that's who Paul's addressing. But tell me if this fits. Brethren, my heart's desire and my prayer to God for Muslims is for their salvation. For I testify about them that they have a zeal for God. Pause. Do Muslims have a zeal for God? Oh yeah. Some of the most zealous people you'll probably ever meet. The really devout ones are. Now there are nominal Muslims, there are cultural Muslims to call themselves a Muslim is nothing more than a cultural identity. They're not religious at all. But the religious Muslims are very, very zealous. So they have a zeal for God, but not in accordance with knowledge. For not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, do Muslims seek to establish their own righteousness? Yep. Through keeping of the law, just like Paul's talking about here. Doing what you're supposed to do, not doing what you're not supposed to do, following Sharia. We're going to talk more about that in a few minutes, what that looks like, and how that affects a Muslim worldview. Not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. Now, I'm reading from the New American Standard. If you have a New King James or something like that, you'll probably see the word submit. They did not submit themselves to the righteousness of God. And I think that's kind of cool because that's what Islam is all about. The word Islam actually means to submit. That's literally what the word means, to submit. And a Muslim is one who submits. Now, point of clarification, I had this question a couple weeks ago at one church that I spoke at. What's the difference between Islam and Muslim? Because a lot of people are unaware of the distinction. Islam is the religious ideology. Islam is the religious system. And a Muslim is one who practices Islam. So Islam is the ideology, Muslim is the people. So the religion versus the people, Islam and Muslim. Just like I don't call myself a Christianity, I'm a Christian. So a Muslim doesn't call themselves an Islam, they call themselves a Muslim, because Islam is the religion, Muslim is the people. So, verse 4, for Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. What's that mean for a Muslim? They can only be set free from the keeping of the law through Jesus Christ. He came to set them free. He came to release them from the bondage. And these are the verses that the Lord gave us when we started the ministry 8 years ago. Now, I'm going to answer three questions tonight. If you're a fan of three-point sermons, I don't know if Pastor Chuck preaches three-point sermons. A lot of half-calories do, but... No? Okay, good. I'm going to answer three questions tonight. What is Islam? Who is Allah? Because there's a lot of misconception about that. And then what's the Christian response? So what is Islam? Who is Allah? And what is the Christian response? So what is Islam? Here's my Islam 101. I'll do it. We'll probably spend about 10 minutes on this. I really want to get into the other topics. But I want to give you guys a basic understanding because this is going to be foundational to the rest of the night and things I'm going to be talking about the rest of the night. I want to first talk about what is the Muslim view of salvation? How do Muslims hope to achieve what they call paradise? We call heaven. They call it paradise. Different words. What do Muslims have to do to earn their salvation? Or can they earn their salvation? In the Quran, I brought my Quran with me tonight. I take my Quran with me everywhere I go. I'm kind of unique. I'm probably the only guy you'll ever see walk into a church with a Quran and the Bible together. So. But I read the Quran. I had to read the Quran from my studies at Biola, but this also gives me open doors with Muslims that I otherwise wouldn't have. One of the very first questions you'll often be faced by a Muslim is, have you ever read the Quran? Because if you haven't, man, you have no business talking to me about my religion. And I'll say, yeah, I've read the Quran. And what it does is it buys me some credibility with them. It opens doors. It gives me an avenue to further engage in a conversation. So don't be afraid to read the Quran. I'll tell you, it's rather repetitious. It's kind of boring. It's a good book to read if you're having difficulty going to sleep. It puts you right to sleep. So I read the Quran. I'm pretty well versed in it. Here's the Muslim doctrine of salvation. It comes from chapter 23 of the Quran, verses 102 and 103. And these verses are repeated in a couple other places in the Quran, but I like the way this one reads in particular. And I've set the stage, verse 101, to put it in context. Verse 101 talks about a trumpet sounding. There's going to be a blast of a big trumpet, and that's symbolic of the end of time, and judgment is coming. Yeah, kind of sounds like the Bible, right? So verse 101, then when the trumpet is blown, there'll be a weeping and gnashing of teeth. No. Verse 102, then those whose scales of good deeds are heavy, they are the successful. And those whose scales of good deeds are light, they are those who lose their own selves, and in hell will they abide. Scales. It's all based on scales. every Muslim is taught, and this is Islamic Theology 101, every Muslim is taught that at birth they were assigned to recording angels. Every Muslim knows this. You can't see them, but these recording angels are assigned to you throughout your life. And one angel records your good deeds, and one angel records your bad deeds. And on the day of judgment, when you stand before Allah, Allah brings out these heavenly scales, and your good deeds are placed on one side, your bad deeds are placed on the other side, and if your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds, you can hope to win Allah's favor and be ushered into paradise. But there's two thoughts here. Number one, the key word is hope. There is no absolute assurance. Because Allah's kind of precocious. He can do whatever He wants, whenever He wants. Even if your good deeds do outweigh your bad deeds, He doesn't have to honor that. We'll see what that looks like more in a moment. But number two, think about this. If your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds, what does that say about your bad deeds? What does that say about sin in Islam? What's the view of sin in Islam? See, one of the things that Muslims talk about when they're dealing with Christians is, you Christians, you've got greasy grace. You can sin whenever you want and just ask Jesus to forgive you. You can live it up as much as you want. That's a misconception, by the way. They don't understand what Paul said about that. Shall we sin that grace may abound? May it never be. But in Islam, what does it say about sin? It's okay to sin. You can do whatever you want, as long as you've got some good to offset it. Sin is no big deal. Live it up. If you do something wrong, if you mess up, if you go astray, all you got to do is do some good or pay some money or whatever it takes to balance out your scales again. It's all based on scales, and I'm going to come back to that multiple times because this is key to understanding the Islamic mindset and why Muslims do what they do. So how does a Muslim load up the scales in their faith? Well, it starts with what I call the five basic pillars of Islam. This is Islam 101. These are the five obligatory things every Muslim has to do in order to be a good Muslim and to load the scales on their faith, to win Allah's appreciation, to win Allah's favor for them. Pillar number one is called the Shahada. S-H-A-H-A-D-A, if you're spelling it out. The Shahada, or the confession of faith. The Shahada is how you become a Muslim. And the Shahada is nothing more than reciting in Arabic, and if you don't know Arabic, there's an imam that'll help you recite the Arabic. Reciting, there's no God but Allah and Muhammad is His messenger. There's no God but Allah and Muhammad is His messenger. These are the first words that are whispered in the ears of a newborn baby. And the last words that are whispered in a person before they take their last breath. There's no God but Allah and Muhammad is His messenger. This is drilled into you day in and day out. And it's how you become a Muslim. You recite that three times in Arabic, La ilaha illallah Muhammadun Rasulallah. Can we say that again? You don't have to write it down. And once you've said that with full intent of the heart, you become a Muslim. And once you have recited the Shahada, or Muslims will use the phrase, taking Shahada. You hear that from Muslims. I took the Shahada. It means they made the confession of faith. They uttered the confession of faith. Once you do that, nobody can ever say you are not a Muslim unless you renounce Islam, unless you apostatize. So once you recite the confession of faith, once you recite the Shahada, you're said to be a Muslim. Here's the danger. Your kids are being taught how to recite the Shahada today in your public school system. Did you know that?
Yes.
I know some of you did. You're shaking your head. Begins in junior high school, usually in seventh grade. In seventh grade, eighth grade, social studies curriculum. Be aware of what your kids are being taught. Because there's nothing wrong with studying Islam as a culture. And they study it as one of several world cultures. But when it gets to crossing the line from cultural studies to religious indoctrination, that's where we have to say no. And when they're being taught to recite verses of the Quran, but we can't have a teacher put a Bible on her desk at school, that's wrong. So, I'll get off my political soapbox now. But this is what's happening in our school systems around the country. This is big. This is huge. There's a great effort to indoctrinate our kids at a very young age into Islam. Islam is candy-coated, Islam is sugar-coated. I have a whole website I developed about 5 years ago, called IslamInOurSchools.com, where I document some of these things in the publisher's textbooks, Prentice Hall and things like that, the major publishers. I actually Xerox-copied pictures of their textbook and then highlight and notate where this is wrong and how it's wrong. And this is where the sugar coating, this is what Islam really teaches. It's one of my hot button topics. Because our kids are being misled. So that's pillar number one, the Shahada. Pillar number two is daily prayers, or Salat, S-A-L-A-T. Daily prayers, a devout Muslim will pray five times a day. And by the way, you won't find anywhere in the Quran where a Muslim is told to pray five times a day. It's not in here. a lot of what Muslims do is not based on the Quran, it's based on the example that Muhammad set, following Muhammad's life. It's called following the sunnah of the Prophet, or the way of life of the Prophet. But they pray five times a day because that's what Muhammad did. There's a whole story behind where how that came about. I don't have time to go into it tonight. It's a fascinating story, though. But they pray five times a day because it's good for the scales. They get up an hour before sunrise, midday, usually about 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock, mid-afternoon, 3:30-ish, sunrise, sundown, sunset, and then an hour after sunset. Five times a day, wherever they might happen to be, they'll roll out their prayer mat, they'll point it toward Mecca, and they go through a number of ritual motions. If they're a devout Muslim, if they're in a mosque, or if they're in some place where they can cleanse, they actually have to go through some cleansing first. It's called wudu. They cleanse themselves, they wash physically, their hands, their elbows, they snort water up the nose and blow it out, they wipe water over their head, and they do this physical cleansing before they enter the spiritual cleansing of prayer. So, but it's all ritualistic. They bow their heads to the ground, they sit back up, they recite verses of the Quran as they're going through all these ritualistic things, and they do it because it's good for the scales. Interesting story. About 3 years ago, at my church in California, the young lady who goes to our church brought her Muslim friend during the Wednesday night service, and I got a chance to talk to this Muslim young lady. After that Wednesday night service, we sat in the back of the sanctuary and talked about an hour and a half. And she said, you know, I've been a Muslim for 22 years of my life. And she said, in the entire 22 years, I do my prayers daily, faithfully. But she said, I got to tell you, every time I pray, I feel like God's not there. She said these words. She says, it's meaningless. She recognized it's ritualistic. She recognized it's good for his scales. She thought it was good for his scales, but she said, there's no connection there. God's not hearing me. I do it because I have to, because I'm a good Muslim. I want to earn Allah's favor. But she said, it's meaningless. God's not there. Her friend Connie had been inviting her to a Bible study. And she said, last week, Connie asked me for the first time in my life to pray to the God of the Bible. And she says, for the very first time in my life, I felt God heard my prayer. 6 months later, we were at Pirate's Cove, there on the beach, where all the Calvary chapels do their baptisms in the ocean. And I had my video camera rolling as that young lady was baptized. Because she recognized there's something in the God of the Bible that she wasn't getting in this one. See, it's possible. They're seeking the true God. They're seeking that connection with the God they know is there. They just haven't been introduced to him yet. So it's about five prayers a day. That's pillar number two. Pillar number three is zakat, Z-A-K-A-T, or obligatory. You could call it obligatory tithing, if you want to look at it that way. Obligatory almsgiving. Every Muslim once a year must donate to an Islamic charity 2.5% of their entire net worth. Now, it's not just their income for the year. It's the whole package of their entire net worth. So if they have to take their income for the year and combine that with any stock holdings they may have received dividends on, or if they have a lucrative business, if they have some extensive land holdings, real estate holdings that are worth so much money that contributes to their net worth, they have to add that all together and donate 2.5%. That's a big chunk of money for a lot of people. And this was originally instituted by Muhammad for a very noble cause. Muhammad grew up in the 7th century Arabia, which was kind of a tribal warfare society. And what do tribes do? They set out to conquer other tribes, right? That's what you do. You go to a nearby tribe, you capture their goods, you take possession of it and make them submit to you. That's what Islam is all about. But that's another story. But in this era of tribal warfare, Muhammad's warriors would go off to conquer another tribe. The men would be killed in battle, and they would leave behind widows and orphans. And Muhammad said, we got to do something about this. We can't let these people go destitute. We need to provide for them. So Muhammad instituted basically an early form of social security, social services. He collected zakat from 2.5%, that's 2.5% tithing, and then divvied it up to provide for widows and orphans and the poor. And, you know, that was a cool thing. It had very noble beginnings. It was a noble gesture. It was the right thing to do. But recently, some of these things have taken a twist for the wrong way. Shall we say a twist for evil purposes. In 2008 and in 2009 in Dallas, Texas, there was a trial of one of these Islamic charities that was collecting all this charitable money from mosques around the country. And in documentation provided by the FBI, the leaders of that Holy Land Foundation, which which is the name of the Islamic charity, were found to be funneling money to Hamas for terrorist activities. And they're now serving long-term prison sentences behind bars. So what started off as good was twisted for evil purposes. Now you have to wonder, if Holy Land Foundation was doing that, how many other foundations are still doing that, taking this charity money and funneling it through terrorist organizations that haven't been caught yet? We don't know. It's very well likely that that may be where some of the terrorist activity is being funded from. But again, this is another pillar. This is how you load up the scales in your favor by donating part of your money for the cause of Allah, for advancing the cause of Allah. Pillar number four is fasting during the month of Ramadan. The Islamic term is Sawm, S-A-W-M, Sawm. Every Muslim must fast from sunrise to sunset for 30 days, for the 30-day calendar month of Ramadan. And they fast from food, they fast from drinking, they fast from smoking, they fast from relations with their spouses. And you can imagine right now, in the heat of summer, in some of the desert areas, or even where I live in Texas, you know, where the summertime temperatures get to, you know, 90 degrees, 100 degrees, 110 degrees, and you gotta go without water all day long, and you're working outside, and you can't drink. Some devout Muslims won't even swallow their own saliva, because that would be displeasing to Allah. You can see right away that this is really a test of endurance. It's said to build self-control, strengthens the power of self-control. There's kind of a sense of camaraderie because all Muslims around the world are going through this thing at the same time, fasting at the same time. So there's a sense of I'm in unity, in unison with my Muslim brothers around the world because we're all going through this fasting at the same time. And interesting statistic. I didn't share this with the church this morning, so this is free for you guys. Muslims, statistics have shown that during the month of Ramadan, when Muslims are supposed to be fasting, there's more food consumed during that time than at any other time of the year in Muslim countries. Which seems kind of odd. If they're fasting, why is there more food consumed? Well, it's because they fast during the daytime, but then they feast all night. And that's exactly what they do. As soon as that sun sets, boy, the wife brings out the food, it's put on the plate, they have a massive feast right after sundown. They party all night. They have another massive feast right before the sun comes up. And when the sun comes up, they sleep all day through their fasting time. At least in the Middle East. Some of them can't get away with that here because they have jobs to keep. But that's essentially what they do. They feast all night so they can fast all day. So it's not really fasting. It's really just a shift of the normal meal times. But it's said to be pleasing to Allah because you're fasting. You're dedicating that time that you otherwise would be doing things for the sake of Allah. And then finally, pillar number five is called the Hajj, H-A-J-J. It's the annual pilgrimage to Mecca, which just happened a few weeks ago. I don't know if you guys saw the pictures. There was 700 people got trampled to death this year. Happens every now and then. But they go to Mecca and they participate in several rituals. Again, it's all ritualistic. There's no meaning behind it. But they run around the Kaaba seven times. The Kaaba is that big black cube you guys have probably seen pictures of. They run around that seven times, and by the way, that's a pagan tradition from pre-Islamic days that Muhammad incorporated into Islam. Muhammad incorporated all kinds of pagan ideas into Islam. He borrowed from Zoroastrianism and Christianity and Nestorianism and all kinds of different religious traditions that he was familiar with. But they run around the Kaaba seven times. They run up and down between a couple hills called Safa and Marwa in honor of Hagar as she was trying to fetch water so that she could nurse Ishmael with. Ishmael's their lead guy from the lineage of Abraham. They throw stones at three concrete pillars, three stone pillars, in order to signify chasing away the evil spirits in one's life. It's called stoning of the devil or stoning of Satan. It was at that particular ritual that these 700 people were trampled last month. And they do all these things because, number one, it's good for the scales. Many Muslims are taught that when they participate in Hajj, once they complete all the rituals there, their scales are wiped clean, all their sins are forgiven. So they can start all over.
Can we wipe clean? Or is that one that Allah can decide not to honor?
Well, no,
Allah doesn't have to honor.
Well, yeah, these are all required though.
Okay.
Yeah. These are the absolute requirements in order to win Allah's favor. If you hope to win Allah's favor, you have to participate in it. But it doesn't mean if you participate that He's necessarily going to grant you favor. See, that's the difference.
Yeah.
If you hope to win Allah's favor, you have to do all these things. So, Once a Muslim has completed the Hajj, they're given an honorific title called Haji. So if you hear some, I've spoken, yes, some of you guys are smiling because it has a different meaning for those of you who have served in the service, in the U.S. Armed Forces. It's kind of a pejorative term.
I've seen a Johnny Quest.
But the Haji is somebody who is elevated on the social ladder. They're looked up to with respect and honor because they've done their Hajj. They participated in this ritual. So it's deemed to be very significant. So these are the five basic pillars that every Muslim must participate in order to load the scales in their favor. Now there's thousands and thousands of other regulations. I'll get to you in a second. Thousands of other regulations known under Sharia. We call it Sharia law. And Sharia law dictates everything a Muslim does from the time they wake up in the morning until the time they go to bed at night. See, here's where Islam is different from any other world religion. Because Islam is not just a religious system. It's a political system. It's a military system. It's a financial system. It's a judicial system. And all these things have dictates under Sharia law. How you're supposed to spend your money. Where you spend your money at. How you're supposed to cleanse yourself. Hiring and firing of employees. Judgment and discipline, court trials, crimes and punishment, all these things are encompassed in Sharia law. And what does crimes and punishment have to do with religion? What does financial transactions have to do with religion? It's not. It's a political system. So Islam is religious and political both. And this is key for understanding the Islamic mindset, because one of the misconceptions that Muslims have about Christianity is that Christianity, well, let me back up a minute. Because Islam doesn't separate the political and the religious and the cultural, it's all wrapped up in the same ball of wax. To say that you're not incorrect when you point to an Islamic society and say that represents Islam. What we see that society doing in terms of its actions, in terms of its mores, in terms of its morality, represents Islam. Because the culture and the religion are all bound up together. So Muslims take that same notion and apply it to America, and they say America is a Christian nation. And so when we look at society and what society produces, that's representative of Christianity. And when they see what the American society produces in terms of pornography and drug abuse and not taking care of our homeless and all these things, they say, that's Christianity. And if that's Christianity, I want nothing to do with it. See, that's a misconception. But that's their view because they don't separate the political from the religious. Keep that in mind, because that's key when you're talking to Muslims. You have to help them understand that what you see Americans do is not necessarily representative of Christianity. And be an example of true Christianity to them. Okay, where was I going? Okay, let's talk about Allah. Who is Allah? I'm going to shift gears now. How many of you have heard, and I'm sure you have, a politician or a media spokesman or even a Muslim apologist say, Christians, Jews, and Muslims all worship the same God, right? Mm-hmm. I think we've all heard that. President George Bush even came on TV after 9/11 and said that, which shocked me, because I don't know if he was just ignorant or if he was just playing politician, if he was being politically correct at the time, so that he wasn't appearing to be insensitive toward Muslims after the whole 9/11 thing. But at any rate, do Christians and Muslims and Jews all worship the same God? Well, I think all of us agree that the answer is no, but how would you respond to somebody who makes that claim? What would you tell them? That's what I'm going to help you do tonight. First of all, let me ask a question. I'm going to get you thinking about something. I'm going to ask a question, and I'm going to ask for a response from you guys. I'm going to ask for a response, and the three possible responses are going to be yes, no, or I don't know. I'm going to give you guys a copy.
Okay.
Yes, no, or I don't know. Here's the question. Is it ever, at any time, and under any circumstance, to refer to the God of the Bible and call him Allah?
No.
How many say no? That's usually the majority, yeah, okay. How many say yes? Nobody. Well, that's a few hands.
Is that their only name for God?
How many say I don't know? I'll get to that in a minute. Okay. I didn't get your question yet. I was curious.
I may have missed it, but the Hajj, do they have to do that only once in their life?
Just once in their lifetime, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's not an annual thing. They just have to do it once. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which is strange because there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, and Mecca can only accommodate about 2 million people. Hmm. So there's no way that every Muslim is ever going to have a chance to go on a Hajj, because Mecca just can't accommodate that many people. So I don't know what they're going to do about that. But that's not my problem. Okay. Is it ever appropriate to call the God of the Bible Allah? Here's why I asked that question. It was a setup. And I'll admit that. But I asked the question to get you guys thinking about something, because in the Arabic language, there's only one word for God. And that word is Allah. Actually, it's not Allah. We in English put the emphasis on the wrong vowel. They don't call it Allah. It's Allah. Allah. And in the Arabic language, Allah is the only word for God. Which means, even in Arabic-speaking Christian congregations, when they read the word God in their Bible, it's called Allah. Allah. When they sing praise songs to God, they sing praises to Allah. A lot of people aren't aware of that. And here's why I bring that up, because this forms the basis for the argument that Muslims use. We Muslims, we worship a God, he's named Allah. Arabic-speaking Christians worship a God, they call him Allah. Same name, must be the same God. Does that make any sense? Think about this for a moment. I usually pick on my wife, but she couldn't be with me tonight. She's back in Texas. But my wife's name is Christine. Now, if I were to go to the local Walmart and see a lady behind the cash register with a name badge that says Christine, would I assume her to be my wife because she shares the same name? See, that argument falls apart. Simply because Allah is the God of Islam, and Arabic-speaking Christians also call the God of the Bible by the name of Allah, does not mean he's the same God, simply because they share the same name. We have to move beyond the labels, and we have to move beyond the title. Actually, Allah is just a title. It's a generic term in Arabic. It just simply means the God. It's a generic phrase. Allah. Allah is God and Allah is the. Allah, the God. So it's a generic term for God in Arabic and nothing more than that. We move beyond the label, we move beyond the titles, and we look at the attributes that define these two gods, the God of the Bible and the God of the Quran. When we examine how they're described in these two books, we see two completely different people, two completely different deities. And this is how I want to help you guys understand and respond to this claim when you hear other people say that Christians and Muslims worship the same God. We do not. Because let's look at the attributes of Allah in the Quran. Number one. The first thing we notice is that the Allah of the Quran shares three similar attributes to the God of the Bible. He's said to be omnipresent. He's everywhere at the same time. He's omnipotent, which means he is all-powerful. He can do anything he wants. And he's omniscient, which means he is all-knowing. He knows everything. So he's everywhere at the same time, he's all-powerful, and he's all-knowing. Share those three attributes with the God of the Bible. And by the way, I think that's part of what Muhammad borrowed from the Bible when he invented the Quran and invented Islam. And make no mistake, Islam and Muhammad go hand in hand. Islam is a man-made religion. The Quran is a man-made book. Muslims believe it to have always been existing on eternal tablets in heaven. It's one of the parallels it has with Mormonism. But when you look at the Quran, you find that it's entirely man-made, with much borrowed from, as I said, the different religious traditions that I mentioned earlier. But beyond those three attributes of Islam, we see something entirely different when we start examining other attributes of Allah, something entirely different from the God of the Bible. For example, number one, Muslims believe and they are taught that everything that happens on earth is a direct result of God's will. It's kind of a hyper-Calvinism on steroids, if you want to look at it that way. What I mean by that is Muslims are taught that everything that happens is a direct result of God's direct intervention. We do nothing on our own accord, absolutely nothing. Let me read you a quotation from a Muslim theologian called Risala al-Bakabi. He says, speaking of Allah, he says, not only can he do anything, he is actually the only one who does anything. When a man writes, it is Allah who has created in his mind the will to write. Allah at the same time gives the power to write, then brings about the motion of the hand and the pen and the appearance upon paper. All things are passive. Allah alone is active. Think about that for a minute. What's this guy saying?
Humans have no free will.
There's no free will. Absolutely. There's no free will at all.
How do you get those scales to move?
We're going to get to that. We're going to get to that because that's interesting. It's a good point. It's a good question you asked. There's absolutely no free will in Islam. Everything that happens is a direct result of God's intervention. When a man writes, it's not him that's making the free choice away. It's Allah, as it were, being a grand puppet master up in the sky and pulling puppet strings and causing us to do everything that happens. We do nothing on our own accord. In fact, I have a book back in my RV at the other church that I'm reading right now. If you're interested in reading more about this, it's called The Closing of the Muslim Mind, where the author just really picks apart this notion and breaks it down into its most intricate details. He says that according to the most devout Islamic theory about this whole thing, everything we see in front of us is an illusion. When I move my hand from here to here, it's not me moving my hand, it's Allah causing my hand at the same time here for my atoms to disappear here, reappear here, disappear here, reappear here, disappear here. He's constantly rebuilding my atoms as I'm moving. And this is what they're taught. Everything happens on earth as a result of God's will. That's why I call it hyper-Calvinism on steroids. There is no free will at all. And that's key, because I'm going to come back to this a couple times. Because you brought up a good point. I'm going to come back to your point. That was excellent. You're ahead of me. Number two, Allah is impersonal. Just like the story I narrated earlier about that young Muslim woman who was praying all the time. She said, there's no connection there. God doesn't hear me. She sensed that because the God of Islam is not a personal God. Muslims are taught that God is so transcendent, so far removed from his creation. He's so distant, we cannot possibly hope to know him in any personal sense. There's not a personal connection there with God. Do we have a personal connection with God? There is a connection with God in Islam. There's a relationship there. God is the master, and Muslims are his slaves. It's a master to slave relationship. You are a slave, and you are nothing more than a slave of Allah. So just like a slave doesn't have any personal connection to his master, he's just there to obey and then do as commanded, so are Muslims to Allah. They're to do as commanded. That's what the whole submission thing is all about, to submit to the will of Allah. You become a Muslim by doing what Allah tells you to do, by being his slave. Now, what's our relationship to our God? These guys are slaves to God. What's our relationship? We're called one of God, right. Children of God, right?
Yeah.
We're children of God. We're allowed to call God by very endearing terms. Father, Abba, right? We're called children of God. Muslims are called slaves of God. By the way, one of the most common names given to male Muslim boys at birth is Abdullah. You might know an Abdullah. Abdullah actually means slave of God. It's a compound Arabic word, which means slave of God. Abd is slave, A-B-D, Abd is slave, Abd, Allah. When you put the two together, it's Abdullah. Abdullah is a slave of God. So Muslims are slaves of God, we're children of God. So do you want to be a slave or a child?
Child.
I vote for child.
Every time.
So already, in the relationship between the two gods, we see something completely different, right? You know, they're both called Allah in the Arabic language. This guy's a master, and his servants are slaves. This guy's a father, and his servants are children. That's astounding. The next attribute is that Allah cannot be said to possess the attribute of love. The God of Islam is not a loving God. Now, I'll unpack that in a minute, but after service this morning, I was asked by one person, does the word love appear in the Quran? Because you'll be challenged by this from Muslims. And yes, the word love does appear in the Quran, but it's always a condition. It's always attached to a condition. Allah loves, and there's a conditional statement. Allah loves those who are righteous. Allah loves those who follow the Prophet. Allah loves those who are obedient. But Allah does not love those who are disobedient. Allah does not love those who obey the Prophet. So it's a conditional type of love. And every time the word love appears in the Quran, you can almost replace it with the word respect and not lose the meaning of the sentence. So it's not really love as true love is defined. It's more of a respectful kind of allegiance toward it. But the God of Islam cannot be said to possess the attribute of love. Now, let me help you understand that. Let's first talk about the Islamic concept of God. The Islamic concept of God is a word that Muslims use in the Arabic language. It's called Tawheed, T-A-W-H-I-D, Tawheed, or T-A-W-H-E-E-D if you want to spell it that way. Tawheed means that Allah is absolutely singular in nature. He's not part of a triune Godhead. In fact, the Quran speaks out defiantly against the Trinity. Say not Trinity, desist, it would be better for you, the Quran says. Allah is absolutely singular in nature, which means before creation existed, before the created order came into being, in eternity past, Allah was all by himself. Okay, hold on to that thought for a moment. Now, think about the concept of love. What does love entail?
More than one person.
When I say I love, I have to say something in order to complete that sentence, right? If I just say, I love, and you're waiting for me to finish up, there's a tension there because I haven't really told you what I love. Because the concept of love requires at least two people in the equation, two things in the equation. You have to bestow love upon someone, or you have to bestow love upon something. Now getting back to Allah, when he was all alone in eternity past before we were created, who was he loving on?
Himself.
Nobody. You can't love on yourself. That's not love. Love is something that's bestowed upon somebody else. Al-Ghazali, a respected, well-respected 10th century philosopher and scholar. Every Muslim knows who Al-Ghazali is. Al-Ghazali makes this comment about Allah and love. He says, to love is to sense a need of the beloved. And since Allah cannot be said to have a need or an experience of need, it is therefore impossible that Allah should love. What Allah is saying is, because if we're to say that God is love, that would require God to have something else or somebody else for him to define who he is. And it cannot be said, God forbid, that Allah requires anything to define who he is. Therefore, Allah cannot be said to be a loving God. So the God of Islam cannot possess, did not have the ability in eternity past to develop the attribute of love. So he cannot be said to possess love. And you see that played out in Islamic societies today. There's no love in a lot of Islamic societies. There's hate, there's fear and anger. Yet in the Western societies, if you go and ask your Muslim neighbors or the guy at the 7-Eleven or the guy in your cubicle at work next to you, do you have somebody you love? Yeah, I love my family. I love my wife. I love my kids. I love my father. I love my mother. Ask them, well, where did you get that love from? You see, if your God in eternity past had nobody to love on, and he never developed the attribute of love, when he created you as a human being, is it possible for him to give you something he himself did not possess? So you claim to have the ability to love, but where'd you get it from? Has our God always been a loving God? The God of the Bible? Always. God the Father, loving on God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, in eternal loving communion with one another. We love, we possess the ability to love as human beings because we're made in the image of God, and our God possesses the ability to love. He gave us that ability. Muslims claim to have the ability to love, but they can't claim to get it from their God. They got the wrong God. They need to come back to the God of the Bible to even understand who they are as a person. The God of Islam is not a loving God. Next, Allah is responsible for both good and evil. Allah, to say it another way, Allah creates evil. Allah is responsible for the presence of evil. In the Quran, chapter 4, verse 78, speaking of skeptics and disbelievers, says, if some good befalls on them, they say, this is from Allah. But if evil comes from them, they blame Muhammad and say, this is from you, Muhammad. So what does Allah tell Muhammad to say? Say, all things are from Allah. In other words, when good comes your way, that's a gift from Allah. When evil comes your way, when evil happens, that's also from Allah. So Allah is responsible for the presence of evil in the world. Is our God responsible for the presence of evil in the world? Does he cause evil to exist? No. Yahweh is all holy, all righteous. Evil actually comes from disobedience. Evil stems from the fall. It's our sinful nature. But in Islam, evil comes from Allah. Hold on to that thought in a moment. We'll come back to that. Next, Allah leads people in righteousness and leads other people astray. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. I was going to give you an illustration. The God of Islam is responsible for evil. If you were watching the news a couple of weeks ago when the Hajj was taking place in Mecca, 2 days before the Hajj started, I don't know if you guys caught this on the news, there was a huge building crane that collapsed and crashed through the dome of the Grand Mosque there in Mecca. Killed like 120 people or something like that. Next day, I was reading online, and that was definitely an evil thing, right? Reading online, an Islamic scholar got on there and said, it was Allah's will. Allah caused evil to happen. It happened because Allah caused it to happen. You can't get away from Allah's will. Which makes sense. If you go back to what I said at the beginning, if everything happens on earth as a result of God's direct intervention, if God causes everything to happen, then when evil happens, it's because God causes it to happen, right? Allah leads people in righteousness and chooses to lead other people astray. Or to put it another way, Allah causes people to sin. That's key. Surah 18, verse 17. Chapter 18 of the Quran, verse 17. Such are among the signs of Allah. He whom Allah guides is rightly guided, but he whom Allah leads astray, for him will Allah find no protector to lead him to the right way. Chapter 14, verse 3. Then Allah sendeth whom he will astray, and he guideth whom he will. Surah 16, verse 93. Chapter 16, verse 93. If Allah so willed, he could make you all one people, but he leaves straying whom he pleases, and he guides whom he pleases. So picture this for a moment. There's God up in heaven. Allah's up in heaven, intentionally choosing to lead some people down the path of righteousness, to load up their scales in their favor, make them be good, make them or do all the good things. And he, by his own choice, by his own fiat, intentionally chooses to also lead people down the path of unrighteousness or causes them to sin and to load up their scales on the bad side. Here's where we have our first theological inconsistency in Islam, and there are hundreds of these that I've discovered over the years. Muslims have 99 names for Allah. Muslims know the 99 names of Allah. They have prayer beads, 33 prayer beads, kind of like a Catholic rosary, where they recite the 99 names of Allah as they circle the beads 33 times. One of the names of Allah is the Just, or the Just One. Now, is it justice for Allah, as we said earlier, if a Muslim scales are heavily weighed against them, with their bad deeds outweighing their good deeds, he's going to send them to hell, as we just read in the Quran a few minutes ago? Is it justice for God to send people to hell for doing the bad deeds that he's causing them to do? If he intentionally leads people astray, then he's the one that's causing their scales to be weighed against themselves. Is that justice? And if you ask a Muslim about this, they'll admit, yes, God causes some people to go astray, but he still holds you accountable for your own actions. And to me, that's what? That doesn't make sense at all. Come again?
That's free will.
Yeah.
So on that one, according to what you just said there, then Allah's responsible for Christianity as well.
That's right.
Which that's is... Right. Kind of crazy.
Why didn't he fix that way back then?
Yeah.
Yeah. Islam is fatalistic. From what we just read, if Allah's going to send people to hell for the evil deeds that he causes them to commit anyway, then what hope is there?
There's no hope.
There's no hope. No hope at all. Now there's an exception. There's always an exception to the rule, as they say. Here's the exception. There's one way for a Muslim to bypass the Day of Judgment, not worry about their scales at all, whether they're good or bad, as to shed their own blood. To become a martyr in an act of jihad. That's why Muslims are blowing themselves up around the world. Or killing themselves in other ways, like flying airplanes into tall skyscrapers. Because it's the only way that their salvation is absolutely guaranteed. To shed their own blood in the cause of Allah. So it explains a lot of things that we see going on around the world. It explains 9/11. Explain suicide bombers in the markets in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.